Last presenter is Dr. Wendy Wilcox. Dr. Wilcox has been a board-certified attending physician in the Bronx, New York for the past 11 years and is currently vice chairperson of the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Women's Health at the North Bronx Healthcare Network comprising Jacoby Medical Center and North Central Bronx Hospitals. She is an assistant professor at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Dr. Wilcox attended Brown University, where she received a degree in biomedical ethics. She became a doctor of medicine at SUNY Health Science Center at Syracuse and received a master's of public health degree from Columbia University.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Let's see, I do not have any financial disclosures to disclose. Oops. What is it?
Left.
Oh, thank you. Okay, so my talk this afternoon is the strategy of incorporating an estimated fetal weight restriction into implementation of an oxytocin policy at a major public healthcare network in New York City. Try saying that 10 times fast. My partners in this project was Joanna Oviedo. She was our research assistant, and Dr. Susan Gross, who is the chairperson of our department. So who are we? We are two member hospitals of 11 hospitals in the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation. We happen to be located in the Bronx, New York. We are both Jacoby Hospital and North Central Bronx. Together, the two hospitals do about 4,000 deliveries a year. What's important to know is that while we are two hospitals, the network and at the departmental level have a single administrative structure. So many of our physicians do go to both hospitals, and again, the hospital leadership and the departmental leadership is the same. The Jacoby Medical Center is one of 11 regional perinatal centers within New York State, which means that they get the most complicated deliveries referred, and also they have a level 4 NICU, so sometimes even after mom delivers, we will get the transfer of the baby at Jacoby. And North Central Bronx is part, of course, of that perinatal center, and so if we get a mom who is extremely preterm or has some very serious high-risk complications, we will then transfer them to Jacoby also within the network. And this is just a picture of one of the newer buildings on the Jacoby campus. The two hospitals are located about 3 miles apart from each other. So we're all, I'm sure, are aware of this. However, despite the U.S. spending more of the GDP on healthcare than any other industrialized country, we rank 17th in the world. And a lot of that's determined by our perinatal mortality rate and outcomes that are largely due to obstetric causes. So, what were our reasons for action? We wanted to improve patient safety in our OBGYN department. We wanted to decrease adverse perinatal outcomes, especially those associated with oxytocin administration. We wanted to decrease claims made and the cost of malpractice. And we want to increase provider and staff satisfaction. And we did this in part by forming a local level IHI group, which I will talk more about in the next slide. But our local level group of IHI is a multidisciplinary group that has physicians, nursing, midwifery, and risk management, and as well as administration on it. I should have mentioned earlier also that Jacoby Medical Center has residents. Both institutions also have medical students, so we are involved in medical teaching. So what is IHI? Well, it's the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, and it's a national non-regulatory agency, unlike JACO. The aim of IHI is to improve the lives of patients, the health of communities, and the job satisfaction of the healthcare workforce. And the principles upon which IHI was based were adapted from the Institute of Medicine's 6 improvement aims for the healthcare system, which include safety, effectiveness, patient-centeredness, timeliness, efficiency, and equity. So our senior leadership actually enrolled our department in the IHI Perinatal Collaborative because they recognized a need to improve perinatal safety within our institution. And as I said, we have a local level version of that. Much of what IHI does is, stands for, is based on the concept of idealized design. So while, especially in obstetrics and gynecology, we know, in medicine in general, we know a lot about what we do in practice and in doing serving patients in perinatal care, we really don't have a good handle on how we do the work. And so it varies a lot from clinician to clinician for both nursing and physicians. So in order to improve the safety and reliability of our care and outcomes, we had to agree not only on the what, but basically in the how we care for our patients. So the concept of idealized design basically sets in place a lot of multidisciplinary processes that have to have the precision of a military exercise and the standardization of a checklist to ensure that the same set of procedures is being followed each and every time an activity is performed. And the concept of bundles really encompasses the idealized design. So the bundle is a group of interventions that is related to a disease process that when executed together result in better outcomes than when implemented individually. And in order to have successful implementation of the bundles, it's kind of an all or nothing strategy. You can't take a piece out here and a piece out there and kind of implement them unequally. You have to have all of the components of the bundle and unless it's medically contraindicated. Many of you might have heard of the central line bundles that IHI developed. So why did we choose oxytocin? Sorry for the blurriness of the slide, and the list is really much longer, but the in August 7th of 2009, the Institute for Safe Medication Practices deemed oxytocin a high alert medication. And it's a high alert medication because it can cause excessive contractions that may stress a baby's circulatory system, which can lead to abnormal fetal heart rate tracings requiring immediate delivery or an emergency C-section. And even if one obtains a vaginal delivery following either oxytocin induction or augmentation, you may have an increased risk of shoulder dystocia or an operative vaginal delivery, which means either delivery by forceps or vacuum. And this is the cover of one of our industry journals. It was published a while ago. And it really shows a baby undergoing what happens during a shoulder dystocia. And so while we do have risks from forceps and vacuum deliveries, the concern for shoulder dystocia remains a very serious medical and legal concern, and it can really cause long-lasting disability in the fetus. The most common definition of a shoulder dystocia is a delivery that requires additional obstetric maneuvers, failure of gentle downward traction to affect the delivery of the shoulders, and it's a definition that is assigned by obstetricians. And the reason why that's significant is because often if you look at chart reviews, you may not see that shoulder dystocia occurred, but when you look at the pediatric record and it has it records a brachial plexus injury, then that's when you pick up that there was a problem with the delivery. Brachial plexus injuries are caused by shoulder dystocia. There is damage to the cervical spine. It depends on where the damage occurs, and you'll get different levels or different syndromes of weakness or paralysis causing inability to move one upper extremity. And brachial plexus injury, as I said before, is assigned by the pediatricians. Here, I've highlighted the types of injuries that may be related to oxytocin administration, and this is really just a listing of common causes for malpractice and injury type. So you can see that if we can even decrease, any of these by even a little bit, or all of them, that it can actually have quite a significant positive effect. So, what's our target state? What do we want to achieve? How do we make sure that what we implement in terms of the bundle is having a positive effect? We monitor about 20 charts a month on an ongoing basis, and we're really looking for 100% compliance with our oxytocin bundle. We gave out a culture of safety questionnaire just to establish kind of a baseline on how safe our providers thought the department was, and we are looking to repeat that about annually, and of course we'd like to see improvement in that. And we also follow clinical parameters. We noticed very early on that, you know, parameters for obstetrics and gynecology didn't show up on the hospital internal dashboard. So while medicine had about 20 parameters and surgery had theirs, we really didn't have any. So we actually volunteered to put several on the hospital dashboard, which get reported monthly. Risk management helps us with that. And we're looking to decrease the number of operative vaginal deliveries, as well as the number of shoulder dystocias and or brachial plexus injuries that occur. We were also following our HCAHPS scores, but there are too many variables for that. So while we do look at those, we are not following those right now as an indication of how well the oxytocin bundle is doing. So gap analysis. Gap is usually, you know, if we do this, then you will achieve thus and so. So if we adopt an IHI oxytocin bundle, we will, one, have a standardized approach to administer the high alert medication oxytocin. Hopefully, we will reduce the number of shoulder dystocias. We will reduce the number of operative vaginal deliveries, and we will improve our culture of safety scores. Our solution approach entailed, of course, adopting the oxytocin bundle. But we also didn't just adopt it the way IHI developed it. We actually added a few parameters of our own. And most notably, we added a fetal weight restriction. And I will discuss that in a few moments. But basically, I wanted to say that all of the policies that have been instituted by IHI and on the local level by our group were based on the following five principles. So uniform processes and procedures equal improved quality, process variation equals poor quality, and our example is the aviation industry, where they have crew resource management, and they have a standardized set of procedures, and on a regular basis, you know, and they use checklists. Principle two is that every member of the obstetric team is empowered and required to intervene and halt any process that's deemed to be dangerous. The automotive industry has an example of this, Toyota Motor Company, and every worker is empowered and obligated to stop the production line if he or she perceives an error. So a lot of our newer policies, nursing has become very empowered in the current system, and we wanted to do that because that will improve the overall safety. Principle number three, cesarean delivery is a process alternative, not an outcome or a quality endpoint. And so what's important is the United States overall has over a 30% cesarean section rate, if you look nationally. Our own rates are lower, but really it's important that we weren't trying to manipulate the cesarean section numbers. We want to make sure that everyone who's received this procedure needed it, and everyone who did not need to get one. So we're not really looking to change those rates. Principle four, rather than attempting to make unusual care more defensible through nonspecific or ambiguous guidelines, and my own college is famous for this, ACOG, malpractice loss is best avoided by reduction in adverse outcomes and the development of unambiguous guidelines. So we really need specific guidelines, specific protocols to guide our providers and our nurses who complain that they're not able to still practice the art of medicine, but we say that as long as they're within the guidelines, they are still being quite artistic. And also to establish an effective peer review, quality assurance committees, and they're essential to quality medical practice. And this has actually been quite a bit of work to really get this up and running. at both hospitals, but again, it's a multidisciplinary group. They're separate from IHI. We include risk management and quality management in them. We are definitely trying to achieve a blame-free culture. And our own hospital association in New York, Greater New York Hospital Association, and I helped to develop this tool, actually has developed a tool to help us in this process. This is an example of our policy. And the new policy is really to ensure standardized process and improved care, standardized documentation requirements. We trained all of the nurses and physicians, as well as residents, in the process for care over several months. And there was a major change. Before, the physicians used to write the order and administer their own PIT, and anyone who's been involved with this knows that we used oxytocin kind of like water. You know, if you didn't see contractions, just kept your finger on the button and kept doing that. Now nursing is empowered and is required actually to initiate the oxytocin. There are specific orders and there's a set of guidelines which are followed, and we've told the physicians to keep their hands off the pump. This is the checklist that we use. It must be done on all patients before oxytocin is started. It incorporates the elements that must be present in order to initiate it. Again, we have the fetal weight restriction, and we have an assessment of a category 1 fetal heart rate interpretation, and 2 signatures are required. So we actually made mandatory the communication between the doctors and the nurses before oxytocin could be initiated. You can start it in a category 2 fetal heart rate tracing, but that requires more documentation. We adopted the NICHD fetal heart monitoring guidelines. It's a 3-tiered system. We gave this ID card to our entire staff. And we instituted mandatory training for the entire staff. And it's actually supposed to be completed annually by all the physicians, midwives, and nursing. And we put it into our recredentialing process. So, why did we add the fetal rate restriction? Methods of fetal weight are notoriously inaccurate, including Leopold's maneuvers and ultrasound when someone comes into the liver. And complications such as shoulder dystocia are directly related to newborn birth weight. The heavier the baby, the more risk of having that. And the ACOG guidelines currently stay, and they were developed a while ago, but they currently stay that you should offer a C-section for babies that are over 4,500 grams for diabetic pregnant women and over 5,000 grams for non-diabetic pregnant women. So our hypothesis was that it's likely to deviate in equal measure above and or below the actual birth weight. So we were always taught in residency, well, the birth, you know, the estimated fetal weight may be off 10 to 15%, you know, either plus or minus in the third trimester. So we actually studied this, and we did a retrospective review of 1,195 patients who delivered between July 1st and December 31st, 2008. Their gestational age was greater than 37 weeks. The estimated fetal weight was calculated by either Leopold's or ultrasound, and we only included singleton pregnancies. And these were our results. We basically found that if the baby was 4,000 grams, estimated at 4,000 grams or more, that our providers pretty much underestimated by about twice as many grams as any other guess. So the provider will significantly underestimate if the estimated fetal weight is 4,000, equal to or greater than 4,000 grams, and on average they will underestimate that by 548 grams, which is a lot. And so it kind of made those ACOG standards not that relevant. So we figured that we had to take that into account in our policy. We made this correction factor as part of the policy. And we do realize that this will probably differ for everyone's own institution, but for our 2 hospitals, this was it. And so in our policy, we said you cannot initiate oxytocin for either induction or augmentation and labor if a fetus has an estimated fetal weight of greater than 4,500 grams for for a non-diabetic pregnant female or greater than 4,000 grams for a diabetic pregnant female. So we brought those ACOG guidelines down 500 grams. So preliminary results say that we have increased compliance with our oxytocin bundle. We have seen that over time. People are adjusting to it, they're getting used to it, and they are following the guidelines. We have found improved documentation with the elements mentioned in the policy. We have been tracking our rates of shoulder dystocia, and we found that they have decreased by at least 50%. We are being quite conservative. They've actually decreased much more, but we need to give it more time to study it. And we have much more improved communication between nursing and our providers. This is just an example of our team. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Okay. The floor is now open for questions. Please.
Everyone here in the Bronx has a big baby, we're going to be doing other C-sections, and that is not what it has to be true. It really has not. So,
just have one. What has been the actual number of shoulder dystocias? What are we talking about? Hundreds? Tens? What changed?
Let's see. So you don't want 10s or 15s because we would be bankrupt, okay? It's a very expensive problem. So for both institutions, I would say an average number of anywhere from, I guess, 3 to less than 10 per month is a problem. Not every shoulder dystocia will result in brachioplexus injury. But the reason why we started to follow the shoulder dystocia rate is because obviously we want to lower the brachial plexus injury rate, but there are more shoulder dystocias that occur, right? And so if you decrease that number, then you should in fact decrease the other number too. So we just wanted to make everyone aware. And so we actually have seen that decrease to, you know, I would say less than 5 per month.
So it's kind of
combined
from 10
institutions.
To 5 now.
Yeah.
I just was curious what the what the actual
and the rate has come down from a rate of 4 at one institution and 2 point something to less than 1% combined.
Without materially changing your C-section rate.
Right.
Which is really interesting.
Right.
Any other questions?
Did you find anything? I didn't figure it out.
Adjustments based on cost of labor services and things like that. So what we wanted to get a handle on was how these adjusters pushed the allocation one way or another from the original allocation. So different adjusters push it to or away from a per capita or per person in poverty allocation, that sort of thing. It was just, I don't want to dismiss it as just a statistical interest because it isn't. It has very practical policy and program implications, and the adjusters that you use in your formula are important. And that's why it's important to know how they behave across a variety of different models.
I guess I was having a hard time. It was one slide where you, I guess that you identified the measures, perhaps, and then another slide where you said that these are the adjusters, and I didn't know how they were different.
Well, there's, you can allocate, and I understand, it's hard to do without examples that you can sort of wade into. So measures of need for service are things like, do you allocate your money per capita, just how many people are in a jurisdiction, or the people who are living in poverty, or the number who are receiving food stamps, or some other measure. And that's for your allocation. But then the adjusters are things like the cost of delivering services, the state's fiscal capacity, like how, what's their wealth, how can they raise that wealth by tax, or what kind of tax, that sort of thing. And then the income inequality measures, like the standard Gini index or others. And so those are the adjusters that tend to bow it away from a per capita allocation because they're looking at another issue. Right? So I know it's complicated. It's, believe me, when we pushed the button, we had, Patrick, like 8,000 different data points that we had to look at. And it was just, it was really ungodly. So it's easy to get lost in the trees in this forest. That's why a number of our adjusters, we just threw out, because it was just far too complicated. So I'm sorry I wasn't clear.
No, I think that makes it more clear. In my mind, I was thinking more of just like risk adjustment, like when you might have different reimbursement schemes based on, your case mix.
Right.
Is it kind of
exactly
the same?
Well, like DISH or or something like that. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Okay.
Trying to take into account those elusive things that we're all trying to get at, but it's just hard to enumerate those.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, this concludes the presentations. Thank you for coming.